Paris in the 1920s was a playground for the literary elite, and Ernest Hemingway captured its essence like no other. A Movable Feast, published posthumously in 1964, has become one of the most beloved literary memoirs of all time. This raw, unfiltered account of Hemingway's formative years as a struggling writer in Paris has influenced countless writers and continues to captivate readers decades later. The book has achieved cult status among creative types. Steve Jobs famously visited Hemingway's Paris haunts after reading it, and celebrities from David Beckham to Patti Smith have cited it as a personal favorite. Its cultural impact extends beyond literature, inspiring films, fashion, and even restaurant concepts that attempt to capture the bohemian spirit of 1920s expatriate Paris. What makes this memoir so enduring is its dual nature, both a nostalgic love letter to a vanished era and a brutally honest account of artistic ambition, friendship, and betrayal. Hemingway's approach to writing was methodical and disciplined, almost ritualistic in its precision and consistency. Each morning he would rise early, typically before dawn when Paris was still quiet, and walk through the cobblestone streets to his chosen café. The Closerie des Lilas became his preferred sanctuary, where the waiters knew to protect his solitude and keep his coffee cup filled. Here, in this haven of marble-topped tables and morning light, he would write until he reached the natural pause point, always stopping when he knew what would happen next, a strategic decision that created built-in momentum for the following day's work. "I would write one page of masterpiece and then another page of masterpiece," he explains with characteristic directness. "I was learning to write simply about each thing I knew, a severe but good discipline." This simplicity wasn't effortless. It was hard won through constant revision and ruthless editing. He would often rewrite a single paragraph dozens of times, stripping away excess until only the essential remained. When faced with creative blocks, Hemingway developed his famous one true sentence technique. All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know. This became his mantra, his way through creative impasses. The truth he sought wasn't necessarily profound or philosophical. It could be as simple as describing the exact color of the sun at dawn, or the precise way a waiter folded his napkin. Between writing sessions, he practiced mental discipline by deliberately not thinking about his work, allowing his subconscious mind to process and solve narrative problems while he immersed himself in the life of Paris, watching boxing matches, visiting the Luxembourg Gardens, or spending hours in the Louvre, studying composition. His writing environment was carefully curated, yet remarkably sparse. The cafes provided ambient sound, the clink of cups, murmured conversations, the hiss of espresso machines, creating what he called a productive loneliness. His tools remained consistently minimal: American-made Moleskine notebooks with blue covers, two perfectly sharpened pencils, and a pencil sharpener. He carried a rabbit's foot and horse chestnut for luck, though he claimed to believe more in discipline than fortune. On particularly good days, when the words flowed naturally, he could create what he called landscapes you could walk through, vivid, sensory-rich scenes that transported readers directly into the story's world. This rigorous discipline extended beyond writing to his intellectual preparation. At Sylvia Beach's Shakespeare and Company, he systematically worked through the masters of literature, not just reading, but studying their techniques. He analyzed Turgenev's handling of dialogue, Lawrence's description of passion, Dostoevsky's psychological depth, and Tolstoy's narrative scope. In the galleries of Paris, he spent hours before Cézanne's paintings, learning how the artist created depth through careful arrangement of color and form, principles he then applied to his prose structure. Every experience, whether reading, observing art, or walking the streets of Paris, became material for his craft, filtered through his disciplined approach to creating clear, honest prose. In a city filled with literary landmarks, Shakespeare and Company stood apart as a sanctuary for the young Hemingway. Sylvia Beach's bookstore and lending library at 12 Rue de l'Odéon became his literary lifeline during the lean years when money was scarce, but hunger for books remained insatiable. The establishment represented more than just a bookstore. It was the heart of expatriate literary life in 1920s Paris, a gathering place where creativity and intellectual discourse flourished despite the economic hardships of the post-war period. The shop itself was warm and cheerful, with a big pot-bellied stove that provided comfort during Paris's damp winters. Comfortable wooden tables invited browsing and reading, while floor-to-ceiling shelves groaned under the weight of carefully curated books in multiple languages. Photographs of writers adorned the walls, authors who looked like they were really alive, even if they were only photographs. These images included Joyce, Pound, and other modernist luminaries who had made the shop their second home. Sylvia herself had a lively, sharply cut face with pretty legs and wore a brown velvet jacket. Her keen literary mind was matched by an even keener sense of which writers needed nurturing, and she possessed boundless generosity toward struggling artists. Despite Hemingway's shyness about his poverty and inability to afford the lending library deposit, then a considerable sum of 12 francs, Sylvia immediately recognized his passion for literature. She made him a card and told him to pay whenever convenient, treating him with the same respect she showed to established authors. "No one that I ever knew was nicer to me," he writes with genuine gratitude. She allowed him to borrow as many books as he wished, never questioning his humble address in the working-class district or his worn clothes. Through Shakespeare and Company, Hemingway accessed the literary education he craved, methodically working his way through the classics and contemporary works. He started with Turgenev's novels, appreciating their clear prose and hunting scenes, then moved to D.H. Lawrence's revolutionary works and Dostoevsky's psychological depths. When he asked about James Joyce, Sylvia mentioned that Joyce usually came in late afternoons, casually introducing Hemingway to a world where literary giants were regular visitors rather than distant figures. This extraordinary concentration of talent in 1920s Paris made Shakespeare and Company not just a bookstore, but a catalyst for artistic development. The discovery of Shakespeare and Company transformed Hemingway's Paris experience in profound ways. When he told his wife Hadley about this wonderful place, describing it as a haven where books and ideas flowed freely, she insisted they pay the deposit immediately, despite their meager finances. Their celebration of this literary treasure became a perfect Paris afternoon. A leisurely walk down Rue de Seine to look at paintings and small galleries, a stop at an anonymous café where nobody knew us for coffee and conversation, and finally a return home for a simple but satisfying meal with wine from the cooperative visible from their apartment window. The bookstore became their anchor in Paris, a place where they could feel connected to the city's vibrant intellectual life despite their limited means. Paris itself becomes a living, breathing character in Hemingway's narrative, its streets and spaces serving as both muse and mentor in his artistic journey. The city's intricate geography shapes not only his daily routines, but fundamentally influences his writing style, providing both physical pathways and metaphorical landscapes for his development as an artist. From their modest apartment atop Rue Cardinal Lemoyne, a sixth-floor walk-up with no running water, multiple paths led down to the Seine, each offering distinctly different perspectives on the city's soul. The direct route descended steeply past weathered limestone buildings and led to what Hemingway described as a dull, industrial stretch near the cheerless Hallovines warehouse district. Better by far, he tells us, to turn left along the sun-dappled quays with their magnificent views of Île Saint-Louis, Notre-Dame's Gothic spires, and the historic Île de la Cité. The riverside bookstalls, Les Bouquinistes, offered unexpected treasures, including cheap American books often abandoned by wealthy tourists at luxury hotels like the Ritz or Crillon, then sold by opportunistic valets for quick profit to the second-hand dealers. Hemingway frequently walked the quays when trying to work through creative problems, finding it easier to think while observing people completely absorbed in their crafts, the boat workers, the booksellers, the artists. At the bow-shaped tip of Île de la Cité, just below the ancient Pont Neuf, stood the proud bronze statue of Henri Quatre, and a small park with spreading chestnut trees where local fishermen worked the Seine's complex currents. Unlike what romantic travel writers claimed about picturesque Parisians fishing for leisure, this was serious, productive fishing by pensioners or laborers on their days off, bringing home real catches of goujon, ablette, and sometimes even anguille. With the fishermen and the life on the river, the beautiful barges with their own life, the tugs with their smokestacks that folded back to get under the bridges, I could never be lonely along the river. The Seine provided constant company and inspiration, its flowing waters a metaphor for the creative current Hemingway sought to tap. The changing seasons in Paris marked the rhythm of Hemingway's creative life with almost liturgical regularity. Spring's arrival brought what he called limitless happiness, though deceptive false springs and bitter cold rains that beat back nature's progress could be frightening in their intensity. The trees along the Seine showed spring's daily advance in tender buds and unfurling leaves until a night of warm wind would bring it suddenly in full force. These seasonal shifts mirrored Hemingway's own creative cycles, periods of flourishing and productivity inevitably followed by necessary retreats and fallow times, each part of the natural order of artistic growth in the city that shaped him. You got very hungry when you did not eat enough in Paris, Hemingway writes with characteristic understatement, capturing the raw reality of an expatriate writer's life in 1920s Paris. The young writer's poverty was not romanticized, but presented as a practical reality that shaped his daily existence and artistic development, a constant companion that both tormented and taught him. Hunger in Paris proved particularly challenging because of the city's celebrated food culture. The bakery shops with their elaborate window displays of fresh croissants and crusty baguettes, the aromatic cafes with their sidewalk tables filled with dining patrons, and the street vendors selling roasted chestnuts all served as daily temptations. Hemingway discovered, somewhat surprisingly, that hunger actually heightened his perception of art. After visiting the Luxembourg Museum on an empty stomach, he found colors more vibrant, emotions more intense, and artistic details sharper. He developed specific walking routes through the city to avoid food shops, carefully navigating the streets of the Latin Quarter until he reached Shakespeare and Company, where Sylvia Beach would notice his increasing gauntness but tactfully avoid mentioning it. Hunger in Paris proved particularly challenging because of the city's celebrated food culture. The bakery shops with their elaborate window displays of fresh croissants and crusty baguettes, the aromatic cafes with their sidewalk tables filled with dining patrons, and the street vendors selling roasted chestnuts all served as daily temptations. Hemingway discovered, somewhat surprisingly, that hunger actually heightened his perception of art. After visiting the Luxembourg Museum on an empty stomach, he found colors more vibrant, emotions more intense, and artistic details sharper. He developed specific walking routes through the city to avoid food shops, carefully navigating the streets of the Latin Quarter until he reached Shakespeare and Company, where Sylvia Beach would notice his increasing gauntness but tactfully avoid mentioning it. Hunger is good discipline, he concludes, finding value even in deprivation, a philosophy that would inform both his writing style and personal ethos. When a payment of 600 francs arrived from the German magazine Der Querschnitt, it represented more than just money. It validated his decision to quit journalism and pursue serious writing. Despite his hunger, he maintained a stoic demeanor, refusing to complain or seek charity. His celebration meal at Lips, beer, potato salad, and sausage, reflected both modesty and dignity in its simplicity. The economics of their Paris existence required meticulous management and creative resourcefulness. Hemingway and Hadley lived frugally in their small apartment on the Rue Cardinal Lemoine, making do with minimal furniture and simple meals. They developed strategies for stretching their money, eating at fixed-price restaurants, buying wine directly from wholesalers, and finding entertainment in free museums and walks along the Seine. When occasional windfalls came, like their successful day at the Engian races, where they won on horses at 12-1 and 18-1 odds, they balanced celebration with prudence, splitting their winnings systematically. A quarter for each of us to spend and half for racing capital. This financial precariousness created a constant tension between artistic integrity and commercial necessity, a struggle that would define much of Hemingway's early career. In conversations with Scott Fitzgerald, Hemingway passionately argued against whoring by writing stories purely for commercial appeal. I said that I did not believe anyone could write any way except the very best he could write without destroying his talent. This conviction, maintained even during his hungriest days, reflected his unwavering commitment to artistic authenticity. The struggle to maintain artistic principles while surviving financially became a central theme of Hemingway's Paris years, a tension that would follow him throughout his career, even after achieving commercial success. These lean years in Paris taught him discipline, focus, and the value of artistic integrity over immediate financial gain, lessons that would shape both his writing style and his approach to the literary marketplace. Paris in the 1920s provided Hemingway with an extraordinary education through his interactions with established writers. These relationships, sometimes nurturing, sometimes competitive, shaped his development and offered lessons in both what to emulate and what to avoid. Gertrude Stein looms large in this literary education. At her apartment at 27 Rue de Fleurus, filled with remarkable paintings by Cézanne, Matisse, and Picasso, Stein offered criticism and encouragement to the young writer. She read his stories, calling Up in Michigan inacrachable, unpublishable, despite being good. She advised him to abandon journalism and instructed him that one must choose between buying clothes and buying pictures. Stein shared her massive manuscripts, talked about painters as people rather than abstract figures, and explained her writing experiments with rhythm and repetition. Yet Hemingway observed her need for publication and recognition to sustain her happiness, particularly regarding her endless book, The Making of Americans. Their friendship eventually ended after Hemingway overheard an intimate exchange between Stein and her companion that revealed a vulnerability at odds with her public persona. Ezra Pound represented a different kind of mentor, the most generous writer I have ever known and the most disinterested. Pound was always doing something practical for artists he believed in, helping anyone in trouble regardless of personal benefit. His greatest concern when Hemingway first knew him was T.S. Eliot, who had to work in a London bank with insufficient time to function as a poet. Pound founded Bel Esprit with wealthy patroness Natalie Barney to raise money to free Eliot from his banking job. Ford Madox Ford provided lessons in what to avoid. Though many loved Ford, Hemingway developed an unreasonable physical antipathy to him, partly due to his bad breath, but also because of another distinct odor that increased when Ford was lying and had a sweetly acrid quality. Ford's dishonesty about money and important matters left lasting impressions on Hemingway about the importance of integrity. These literary relationships formed a crucial part of Hemingway's education, teaching him not just about writing techniques, but about the character required to sustain a literary life. Among Hemingway's literary relationships, his friendship with F. Scott Fitzgerald stands out for its complexity and poignancy. When they first met at the Dingo Bar, Hemingway was immediately struck by Fitzgerald's appearance. A boy with a face between handsome and pretty, with fair, wavy hair, excited eyes, and a delicate, long-lipped Irish mouth. But it was Fitzgerald's talent that truly impressed Hemingway. His talent was as natural as the pattern on a butterfly's wings. Their relationship began during what Hemingway called a good time in his writing, if not his life. Fitzgerald had just published The Great Gatsby, which wasn't selling well despite excellent reviews. Hemingway recognized the book's quality and realized that no matter what Scott did nor how he behaved, I must know he was a fine writer. Yet Fitzgerald's behavior often tested this respect. During their journey to retrieve Fitzgerald's abandoned car from Lyon, Scott missed their train, worried obsessively about congestion of the lungs, and passed out during dinner. Throughout these episodes, Hemingway observed Fitzgerald's vulnerability and insecurity, particularly regarding his relationship with his wife Zelda. The destructive dynamic between Scott and Zelda became increasingly apparent to Hemingway. Zelda was jealous of Scott's work, he writes. She was jealous of everything he did. Their pattern became familiar. Scott would resolve to work regularly, exercise, and avoid all-night drinking. He'd start working well, then Zelda would complain about boredom and pull him into another drunken party. They'd quarrel, make up, and Scott would walk with Hemingway to sweat out the alcohol, determined to work again, until the cycle repeated. Despite these challenges, Hemingway maintained loyalty to Fitzgerald when he was sober. "For years, I had no more loyal friend than Scott when he was sober." He recognized Fitzgerald's genuine talent and potential, believing he could write even better than the great Gatsby if given the chance. This complicated friendship reveals Hemingway's capacity for seeing beyond behavior to recognize true artistic merit, even while maintaining clear-eyed observations about human frailty. When Paris became too difficult with a baby in winter, the Hemingways escaped to Schruns, a sunny market town in Austria's Vorarlberg. These seasonal migrations provided not just physical comfort, but creative space away from the distractions of Paris. The Taube Hotel offered large rooms with big stoves and comfortable beds. Meals were simple and excellent, and the pension cost about $2 a day for the three of them. In this affordable sanctuary, Hemingway found ideal conditions for work. "Schruns was a good place to work," he writes. "I did my most difficult rewriting there in the winter of 1925-26, when I had to take the first draft of The Sun Also Rises apart and rewrite it. Their days followed a pleasant rhythm. Mornings began with the maid making a fire in their porcelain stove, followed by fresh bread, preserves, coffee, eggs, and ham. They enrolled in Herr Walter Lenz Alpine Skiing School, climbing mountains on foot carrying their skis, using seal skins attached to the bottoms for deep snow. At valley tops were alpine club huts where climbers could sleep. In those days before ski lifts, you had to climb up to earn your run by climbing," Hemingway explains. This physical discipline mirrored his approach to writing, putting in the difficult work first to earn the exhilarating creative flow that followed. Evenings brought celebration with light or dark beer, new wines, Kirsch and Enzian schnapps. Sometimes they had jugged hare with rich red wine sauce or venison with chestnut sauce. They played poker with locals, the hotel keeper, ski instructor, banker, prosecutor, and gendarmerie captain, despite gambling being forbidden in Austria then. These winters in Schruns provided both physical restoration and creative productivity, allowing Hemingway to balance the intense social engagement of Paris with periods of focused work and outdoor activity. The rhythm of seasons, Paris in spring and fall, Schruns in winter, created a sustainable pattern for his writing life. The final sections of A Movable Feast take on a more somber tone as Hemingway reflects on the dissolution of his first marriage and the end of what he viewed as an innocent period in his life. "Our first year in the Vorarlberg was innocent," he writes, "but the third year became a nightmare and a murder year disguised as the greatest fun, the year the rich arrived." Hemingway introduces the concept of the pilot fish, who always precedes the rich, sometimes deaf, sometimes blind, but always affable. This figure speaks hesitantly, defending the rich with phrases like, "I do like them truly," and "there's something damned fine about her." Once the rich arrive, nothing remains as it was. This metaphor captures how external forces began to disrupt the delicate balance of the Hemingways' life together. The memoir's most poignant passages deal with Hemingway's guilt over the end of his marriage to Hadley. "I recall that terrible winter when my marriage fell apart," he writes. "Two people in love create a beacon that attracts others, but we were inexperienced in handling this attention." He confesses to the destructive experience of loving two women simultaneously, lying to everyone, breaking all promises. Though he doesn't name Pauline Pfeiffer directly in these passages, she was the young woman who became my wife's friend, then set out to marry me. The rich, he notes, backed every ruthless decision I made, though he acknowledges he can't blame them entirely for his choices. Remorse became his constant companion for 3 years, only lifting when Hadley married a better man than himself. This honest acknowledgement of his failings gives the memoir its moral complexity and emotional depth. Paris itself changed as they changed, but it was always Paris, a constant amid personal upheaval. The book ends with a bittersweet reflection on those early days when we were very poor and very happy. Though Hemingway burned much of what he'd written about that time, he promised he wouldn't forget about the writing. That was what I was born to do. This final affirmation of his vocation, despite personal failings, gives the memoir its ultimate meaning, a testament to the enduring power of art amid the messiness of human relationships.